This is edition number 2004 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 13th of February, 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 12th of February, 2026. My name is Bill Newby-Grant and my fellow readers are
Claire Hill,
Hilary Newby-Grant
and Mary Wilson.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 7:15 a.m. and will set at about 5:15 p.m.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes Caring Robots, A Secret Village, Love Sonnets and A Comedian.
But we begin with the main news items, which include traffic fears for a huge new development, the inquest into the death of a married couple, the latest on that bus shelter row and new plans for a former hospital. Let's start with those lead stories.
A master plan to build 1,800 new homes in a Norfolk town has sparked serious safety fears as it moves forward. The North Walsham West development, which would see the town's population increase by 34%, has taken another step forward, with plans due to be submitted to the council imminently. But following the latest consultation, some people living in the town feel there are still serious concerns about the safety of the roads, which will see huge increases in traffic. This includes Aylsham Road, which is the only route for HGVs and buses through the town, as the railway bridge is the only one high enough to accommodate the larger vehicles. Bernie Marfleet of the campaign group Save Our Streets said, "There are no proposals to address the serious safety issues on the pavement-less parts of Aylsham Road. We know from the experience of the unofficial diversion over the first 6 months of 2025 that the situation can quickly become chaotic, dangerous and damaging without proper management and control over rat running. This frightening experience is a foretaste of what will happen, but on a permanent basis. It comes after chaos ensued when the council undertook a £750,000 project to improve the junction of Norwich and Yarmouth Roads on the town's bypass at the beginning of last year. People had said that while the work took place, the town's narrow roads without pavements were used as rat runs, with drivers regularly flouting 20-mile-an-hour speed limits. Locals had reported collisions, damage to property, and pedestrians being clipped by vehicles, often finding it nearly impossible to walk down the streets. The consultation documents suggested a number of highway improvements have been proposed, which include a new link road through the development connecting Norwich Road to Cromer Road. This road would be subject to a 30-mile-an-hour speed limit, no on-street parking, would offer crossing points for pedestrians and cyclists, and new bus stops. It said, "This link road will reduce traffic on local roads and improve HGV routing." The developers also proposed to provide a signalised shuttle system at the railway bridge on Aylsham Road, where one-way movements are controlled by traffic signals. But the campaigners and the town mayor Bob Wright have said this is not enough, as the link road does not currently connect to the industrial estate, leaving HGVs to continue using Aylsham Road. The Save Our Streets group, which has been campaigning for safer roads in the town for more than 25 years, has suggested a number of ideas to be included with the master plan. They believe that restrictions should be placed on traffic on Aylsham Road, except for the buses and lorries, as well as other vehicles which require access. Other suggestions include traffic calming measures and speed cameras to enforce the speed limit. But this is not their only plea. Mr. Marfleet said, "We urgently need the support from our elected representatives to make sure the proposed development is carried out in a way that does not irretrievably harm the safety and prosperity of the town's residents." Rob Nee, also of the group, added, We don't have someone sticking up for the town at a critical moment. North Walsham needs a champion. This is the future of our town. The 257-acre site for the development was adopted in the North Norfolk Local Plan for 1,800 homes, community facilities including a new primary school and the Link Road. As of the 2021 census, the population of North Walsham was 12,630. The average household in the UK consists of 2.4 people. If the new properties followed this pattern, the town would increase by around 4,320 people, which is 34%. The timeline that was proposed on the consultation said that the hybrid planning applications will be submitted early this year and hopes that North Norfolk District Council will determine it by the spring of 2027. If it is approved, the target start date on the site would be 2028.
A married couple who had been celebrating Christmas with friends at their local church died together after being struck by a car as they crossed a dark Norfolk road, an inquest has heard. Sheila and Campbell Welsh, aged 81 and 82, suffered catastrophic injuries after being hit by a Mini Cooper outside the carol service they had attended with friends in High Kelling near Holt on December the 22nd, 2024. The hearing at Norfolk Coroner's Court heard the popular retired couple had been enjoying mulled wine and mince pies with fellow parishioners moments before the collision and were looking forward to spending Christmas with family and friends. Instead, members of the congregation witnessed the horrifying aftermath as emergency services fought in vain to save them in the road outside the church. Their son, Brian Welsh, a retired fire officer, paid tribute to his parents' long and active lives, firmly rejecting any suggestion their deaths were intentional. "My parents loved life and were making plans for the future," he said. "They adored their family and were looking forward to Christmas." He stressed both parents were normally extremely careful road users, adding that Mrs. Welsh had always insisted on teaching her grandchildren how to cross roads safely. The couple had moved to Holt around 12 years earlier, after downsizing from Welwyn Garden City, quickly becoming part of the local community. Mr. Welsh enjoyed a successful career with Cadbury Schweppes before taking early retirement and later working as a brewery director. A former rugby player and army reservist, he remained active into later life, tending his allotment and cycling regularly. Although slowed in recent years by back problems and nerve surgery, his son described him as sharp-minded and a trusted source of advice for the family. Mrs. Welsh, originally from Scotland, worked for many years as a secretary at British Aerospace. She was also an accomplished pianist, and known for her lively, warm and vibrant personality. Friends described both as energetic and sociable, regularly cycling long distances and meeting friends in local pubs and church gatherings. Retired music teacher Christine Mangan, a close friend, told the court, "Sheila was not your typical 81-year-old. We would often cycle 30 miles together. They were both so full of life." On the evening of the collision, parishioners stayed after the carol service to socialise, enjoying mince pies and mulled wine. Witness Claire Bennett recalled chatting with Mrs. Welsh, who spoke happily about friends and family coming to stay over Christmas. Shortly afterwards, as people began leaving the church, a loud metallic bang rang out from the road. Mrs. Mangan said she discovered Mrs. Welsh's crushed glasses in the road before recognising her friend lying injured nearby. Mr. Welsh had been thrown further away by the impact. It was then she saw a person she assumed to be the driver involved, who was very upset. Mrs. Mangan said she heard him say, "Are they still alive? Don't tell me they're dead." Members of the congregation called emergency services, but despite prolonged efforts by paramedics, both were pronounced dead at the scene. Medical evidence showed both suffered multiple catastrophic musculoskeletal injuries, with pathologists concluding their injuries were not survivable. A police collision investigation concluded the Mini Cooper involved was being driven safely in a 30 mile per hour zone on the A148 towards Cromer, with no evidence of distraction or vehicle defects. Another witness told the court that they heard the distraught driver say, "They just walked in front of me. I didn't see them. They were just there." The stretch of the A148 where the collision occurred has no street lighting. Investigators found the couple had been wearing dark clothing without reflective material and were crossing from the westbound side into the eastbound lane when they were struck. The court heard that in such conditions, pedestrians may only become visible when directly illuminated by vehicle headlights, leaving drivers little or no time to react. Given the couple's age and Mr. Welsh's mobility issues, investigators concluded they would have been crossing slowly and were likely unsighted when they stepped into the path of the vehicle. Forensic evidence suggested that Mr. Welsh was struck by the vehicle first, with his wife to his right side. Assistant coroner Christopher Leach recorded both deaths as resulting from a road traffic collision, stating the evidence showed the driver could not reasonably have avoided the collision. He also offered sympathy to the driver and said he hoped the inquest findings would reassure him that he was not responsible for the horrendous tragedy.
A potential design which will decide the fate of the notorious Sheringham bus shelter may only retain some of the structure, council has said. Sheringham Town Council has released a statement about what is next for the bus shelter off Station Road, revealing that the work on the site is unlikely to begin until autumn. And while the designs are being explored behind closed doors, councillors have hinted at what options are on the cards. The statement said, "At the moment, we're working on a possible design that would retain some of the shelter's structure whilst allowing the essential pavement widening. Before we can share this publicly, some technical assessments need to be carried out, including obtaining the opinion of a structural engineer. The 1950s structure was due to be demolished in the Norfolk County Council's travel hub plans. But the work was brought to a halt in December when demonstrators staged a fierce protest to save it. The Town Council has since had several meetings on the project and how to move forward and meeting with the Save Our Shelter campaign group and the NCC to discuss designs." The statement added, "We want to reassure residents that we are working hard to put in place a suitable and sustainable plan to move forward. We are pleased to confirm that positive progress continues to be made. We are working closely with Norfolk County Council to agree a way forward. However, the original completion date for the scheme will no longer be possible." NCC also released a statement which said that the completion of the travel hub is dependent on factors such as full design and feasibility of alternative options being carried out and contractor availability. County Hall officials also wish to avoid the summer peak season to keep any disruption to a minimum. The earliest, therefore, that we are likely to be able to start any works is autumn 2026, the statement said. Other options that had previously been revealed by the council included relocating or remodelling the shelter as it explores all viable possibilities.
A former private hospital closed down after the deaths of three people is to continue to be used to house up to 100 migrant workers working for Bannum Poultry. Causton Park Hospital, near Elsham, shut in 2021 after the deaths of Ben King, 32, Nicholas Bryant, 33, and Joanna Bailey, 36, who all had learning disabilities within 2 years of each other. A scathing report revealed a string of failings by Durham-based owners Giesel Group, which closed down the hospital after inspectors from the Care Quality Commission put it into special measures. Bannum Poultry and Pandora X, a company owned by former Giesel chief executive Tugay Ackman, subsequently obtained temporary permission from Broadland District Council to use the disused hospital to house migrant workers for 18 months. The workers are employed by Bannum Poultry in Attleborough and work shifts, with buses taking them to and from the site. After the initial permission expired, the council agreed in 2023 to extend it for a further 18 months. But that permission has now expired, so the applicant asked the council for another extension so workers could be housed there for a further 18 months until November this year. Officers at Broadland District Council have permitted the extension, but have sought assurances over the long-term future of the site. They say temporary permissions are not a long-term solution, and the local planning authority would be expecting a more permanent solution to the future use of the building to come forward. The applicant has told council officers that it has been actively pursuing a viable and deliverable long-term redevelopment strategy, and that significant and tangible progress has been made. They said an interested party has a vision to redevelop the estate, providing homes with care for older people, and discussions with investors and care operators are ongoing. The applicants told the council that it hoped to submit a draft master plan to the council by the end of March, with an outline planning application following soon afterwards.
A network chief has urged MPs, councillors and the public to stop objecting to new masts in Norfolk, arguing objectors are hampering efforts to improve mobile phone signals. Gareth Elliott, director of the Policy and Communications at Mobile UK, was grilled on why coverage is bad in parts of North Norfolk by councillors at a recent meeting of North Norfolk District Council, the NNDC. When asked what the biggest blockers to improvements to the phone signals were, he raised problems with MPs and councillors objecting to new masts being built in the district. However, he also admitted rural areas are not always economically viable for investment in the network infrastructure. Mr. Elliott said, "We've seen, for instance, MPs who have objected to masts and councillors objecting to masts too. That in itself is a blocker. Planning applications have gone through due diligence to understand how it affects the existing network and radio physics. We don't just build masts anywhere and everywhere." In recent years, there have been a number of applications for new masts in North Norfolk and elsewhere, which have been met with fierce resistance from villagers. One example in Erpingham was blocked following opposition from former Conservative MP Duncan Baker, councillors and locals. However, at the same time, there was also significant support for the mast, with people complaining about the poor mobile phone signals in the village. Mr. Elliott urged councillors to work with companies to help change the narrative around masts amid negative perceptions of what masts would look like in the environment. Concerns around the health effects of masts can also influence objections, despite experts saying they are unlikely to pose any risks. But Councillor Andrew Fletcher said, "There is a good deal of anxiety, not just amongst NIMBYs and people being militantly ignorant, but that things are happening behind their backs." He urged phone companies to do more to communicate with people about their plans to ease any concerns. Mr. Elliott also admitted that companies must consider the economic viability of investing in rural areas and that some projects will require public money. He pointed to the £1 billion Shared Rural Network Fund, which has helped boost coverage in Wales and Scotland. During the scrutiny committee meeting, Mr. Elliott was told that problems with poor mobile phone signals is having a real-life consequence for people living in North Norfolk. Data presented by the council showed large swathes of the district either have no data or it is very poor. Places like Holcombe, Raynham, Scotto, Ittringham, Potterheim and Walsingham are all facing problems with the so-called not spots. Senior HM Coast Guard officer John Payne said the emergency service battles with knot spots across the coast, which affects their ability to communicate with each other. We find connectivity extremely patchy, he added.
Officials are investigating ways to make the North Norfolk coast more ethnically diverse, after a government-commissioned report suggested those who enjoy the countryside are too white and middle class. They're coming up with programmes to attract people from minority communities to the county's coastline as part of a nationwide plan to change the demographic makeup of visitors to beauty spots. It follows a Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, review of the Norfolk coast and other officially designated national landscapes, previously known as areas of outstanding natural interest. It described such areas as an exclusive, mainly white, mainly middle-class club. Another DEFRA report said rural facilities, such as country pubs, cater to white English culture. Officials responsible for the Norfolk Coast National Landscape are now coming up with ways to address these points. However, critics say the initiative is divisive and insulting. Julian Kirk, reform leader at County Hall, said, "It's nonsense. It doesn't matter what group you belong to. Everybody has the same access to the countryside as everybody else." Rupert Lowe, the independent MP for Great Yarmouth, dubbed it woke vomit. The DEFRA review, carried out in 2019, investigated all 46 of the UK's national landscapes, previously called Areas of Outstanding National Beauty, as well as its 14 national parks and the Broads. It said landscape bodies had not moved smartly to keep up with changes in society and described countryside areas as an exclusive, mainly white, mainly middle-class club, with too little being done to encourage first-time visitors. A further report for DEFRA in 2022 also found rural facilities cater to white English culture, pointing to the close association to traditional pubs which have limited food options and cater to people who have a drinking culture. Accordingly, Muslims from the Pakistani and Bangladeshi group said this contributed to a feeling of being unwelcome, the report said. Many communities in modern Britain feel that these landscapes hold no relevance for them, the report continued. The countryside is seen by both black, Asian and minority ethnic groups and white people as very much a white environment. If that is true today, then the divide is only going to widen as society changes. Our countryside will end up being irrelevant to the country that actually exists. In response, national landscapes and local councils have committed to a range of targets to increase the diversity of people enjoying beauty spots. Locally, the Norfolk Coast, the county's only national landscape, has said it is developing long-term programmes to increase the ethnic diversity of visitors over the next 5 years. It is one of its key targets in its current management plan, but exact details of how this will be delivered are yet to be published. Officials said they would improve engagement with diverse audiences, including people from the global majority, different socio-economic backgrounds, and those with varied access or communication needs. In other areas, more detailed management plans outlining proposals to attract more minority communities have been unveiled. For instance, the Chiltern National Landscape will launch an outreach programme in Luton and High Wycombe targeted at Muslims. The 2019 DEFRA review said it expected all national landscape bodies to produce ambitious strategies to increase diversity of access for marginalised groups, which should include measurable delivery indicators, against which they will be assessed by the National Landscape Service. In a statement yesterday, the National Landscapes Group said it has a vision for 2050, where protected landscapes form the backbone of a nature-rich UK, with thriving rural communities and people from all backgrounds who feel connected to nature, enjoying green spaces and taking nature-positive actions. UK nature needs all the friends it can get, and the more people feeling connected and taking nature-friendly actions, the better for everyone, a spokesman added. However, critics have argued the findings of the report could be insulting to ethnic minorities, as it presumes they would not have any interest in rural England and its culture. Mr. Kirk called the diversity drive a box-ticking exercise. He said it will prove pointless. As a farmer, I would be more concerned about too much access. Sheep worrying is more of a concern than allegedly not providing access to the countryside for ethnic minorities.
A man accused of murdering a 73-year-old neighbour in a house fire at a Norfolk coastal property is to undergo further tests to see if he is fit to enter pleas in the case. Christopher Brooks was charged following a fire at Walcott, in which Robert Button was seriously burnt. Mr. Button, who died later in hospital, was found following a blaze thought to have started in the doorway of his home in Coastline Village off Ostend Road on Sunday, December the 7th last year. Brooks, who has also been charged with criminal damage to Mr. Button's Nissan Navara, appeared at Norwich Crown Court via video link from prison on Tuesday for a plea and trial preparation hearing. But the court was told the plea hearing needed to be adjourned, as 40-year-old Brooks, who appeared in the dock wearing a grey jumper and dark grey jogging bottoms, needed to see a psychiatrist to establish whether he was fit to enter a plea. The plea hearing was adjourned until March the 30th, when Brooks will, if deemed fit, be expected to say whether he is guilty or not guilty of the charges he faces. Andrew Oliver, who defends Brooks, said he had already seen a psychiatrist once, but requires a second appointment with him. It is understood the appointment, including a fitness to plead investigation, will take place before the end of the month, with a subsequent report expected to be ready in 6 weeks' time. Brooks, of Coastline Village, Walcott, is expected to stand trial on June the 8th, a date previously set by Judge Alice Robinson at an earlier hearing. Mr. Oliver said both the defence and prosecution were hopeful that they would be able to still meet that date for the trial, which is expected to last 2 weeks. Andrew Jackson appeared for the prosecution, with Mr. Oliver in court to represent Brooks. Mr. Button was initially taken to the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital after the fire at around 5 p.m. on December the 7th, 2025. But he died in the early hours of the following Monday morning after he succumbed to his injuries. Detective Chief Inspector Kev Barker from the Norfolk and Suffolk Major Investigation Team has confirmed that both the victim and suspect were known to one another and were neighbours.
Plans are being worked up for a new multi-million pound roundabout dubbed one of the single most important infrastructure investments in the county at the entrance to a Norfolk town. Norfolk County Council is gearing up to lodge a planning application for the new roundabout at the junction where the A148 Holt Road turns off to Holway Road in Sheringham. There have long been calls for a roundabout at that spot to replace the current T junction, with critics saying the current road setup is dangerous. There have been 4 recorded crashes at that location in the 5 years between 2020 and 2024. A casualty suffered serious injuries in one of those crashes, while slight injuries were recorded in the other 3. Norfolk County Council previously carried out a £50,000 feasibility study for the project, but is now making preparations to submit plans for the roundabout. The council commissioned London-based consultants WSL to put together an environmental impact assessment scoping report into the project. That report assesses the likely environment impacts of the scheme, which is within the Norfolk Coast National Landscape. While designs for the three-arm roundabout are at an early stage, it is likely the council will have to obtain private land to enable it to be built. Some 75 metres of land to the east and nearly 40 metres to the west. The council said the cost has yet to be established, but it had previously been estimated a roundabout in that location would cost about £3 million. Graham Plant, Conservative-run County Hall's Cabinet Member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said, "We're currently in the preliminary design stage of looking at a new roundabout at the Holt Road and Holway Road junction. This will help us understand clearly the potential costs, impacts and benefits of the scheme. Once we've completed that work, we can then look at suitable funding arrangements and work towards submitting a full planning application." 2 years ago, Michael Gove, then the Government Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, told the House of Commons, "Sheringham Roundabout is one of the single most important infrastructure investments in Norfolk." That was in response to a plea from Duncan Baker, North Norfolk MP at that time, to provide money for the long-demanded scheme.
Our next few news stories include Norfolk's hidden crisis, expansion plans for a business park, seawall update, and cafe owners' rape trial.
Shocking figures have revealed a hidden crisis in Norfolk. 1 in 12 adults have been sexually abused or raped, with hundreds left on waiting lists for support. Nearly 600 victims are waiting for specialist help as demand for support in Norfolk reaches breaking point, a local charity has warned. At least 1 in every 12 adults in Norfolk is living with the trauma of sexual abuse, sexual violence or rape, according to new figures. The scale of suffering across the county has been laid bare by specialist support charity Sue Lambert Trust to mark Sexual Abuse and Sexual Violence Awareness Week, which runs from February the 2nd to February the 9th. The charity says the horrifying statistic applies only to people aged between 18 and 74 who have disclosed or reported abuse, meaning the real figure is likely far higher, with many survivors never coming forward. To highlight the scale of the crisis, university sports teams have joined forces in solidarity with survivors, forming teams of 12 players to represent the stark reality that at least 1 in every dozen adults is affected. Sports teams from the University of East Anglia Students' Union wanted to help bring the statistics to life for maximum impact. Alicia Coutan, Women's Officer at UEA Students' Union, said, "Sexual abuse, rape and sexual violence is far more common in our communities than many people realise. Victims often remain silent, carrying shame and pain alone. This week is about speaking up for survivors." But the charity warns support services are now under immense pressure, with demand outstripping capacity. Its counselling waiting list currently stands at 588 people, with more survivors in Norfolk seeking help every month. Since launching an online self-referral system last August, the charity has received an average of 90 new referrals each month. Campaigners say the figures show the urgent need for greater funding and support. Research has shown survivors of sexual abuse are significantly more likely to experience mental health conditions, including depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Tragically, they are also 6 times more likely to attempt suicide. Clive Evans, chief executive of the Sue Lambert Trust, said, "The impact of abuse is all around us, even if it remains hidden. Friends, colleagues, classmates or teammates, we will all know someone who is living with this pain, whether they tell us or not," he said. "Every survivor deserves to be heard and supported, whether or not they have reported what has happened to them." Mr. Evans added, "Asking for help takes enormous courage. Survivors should not be left coping alone while waiting months for specialist support. We urgently need long-term funding so no one in Norfolk suffers in silence. The charity says awareness campaigns launched this week aim to show survivors they are not alone and to encourage anyone affected to seek help.
A business park in a rapidly growing Norfolk town is set to triple in size, new plans have revealed. Sam Cordner, the owner of the Aylsham Business Park, has unveiled his vision for the site by the A140, which includes building more than 20 new commercial properties. And for Mr. Cordner, this is an important bid for the future of his hometown. I want to see it work for Aylsham because I think it's needed. The industrial sites are full and there is nothing to rent commercially, he said. This project is going to create a massive amount of employment. Like many communities across Norfolk, Aylsham is set to see significant housing growth over the coming years, bringing a host of challenges for local schools, doctors, transport and parking. Mr. Cordner, who now lives in Marsham with his wife Chloe, was concerned that there were not the employment opportunities available to meet the fast-growing population of the town. We are creating employment, and the council wants that, he added. His project, under his company Aylsham Development and Construction, includes several phases which may take up to 3 years to complete. The current stage includes six new commercial buildings to the back of the existing site, which consists of 12 offices, with the plans now submitted to Broadland Council. Mr. Cordner said his goal is to have the plans passed in the next 8 weeks and all six of the units completed by the end of summer. He added that he had a big player who wants to take on two of the buildings as soon as possible, but could not reveal who it is. The next stage includes another six properties, and the final is then the largest expansion with another 10 buildings, with some split into two units. Overall, the site will offer 36 units if the current plans go ahead.
Work to relocate a car park in a Norfolk village battling coastal erosion is due to complete by the summer, a council has confirmed. North Norfolk District Council has started the first phase of construction of its new car park in Haysborough off Lighthouse Lane. It comes as rapid erosion has left its existing car park at risk of crumbling into the sea. And as work is underway on the major project, council officials have said it may be the early summer when it is completed. A spokesman for the council said, "The actual delivery and handover date is subject to a lot of variables, including the weather and any potential impact from erosion events, but it is expected to be early summer, hopefully before school holidays begin." The first phase of the scheme focuses on the new site with the excavation and formation of ground levels, the installation of the car park's foundation and the construction of its surface. Then road markings, parking equipment and fencing will all be added to the new car park, alongside landscaping works before it is then open to the public. The second phase of the project is the removal of the existing car park, which includes the removal of the existing surface materials and backfilling the area. Drivers will be able to continue to use the current car park area until the new one is completed. It is the second time in 15 years that Haysborough's car park has had to retreat inland. The current car park was moved to its present site in 2011 under a pathfinder scheme after the previous facility was lost to the sea. Most recently, funding from Coastwise, a government-funded scheme aimed at getting coastal communities ready for climate change, has been used to maintain access to the existing car park. While this has extended the life of the site, the solution is only temporary and after erosion would eventually make vehicle access unsafe.
Council leaders are ready to spend more than £3 million to provide care to people in new homes due to be built in a Norfolk town. Norfolk County Council's Conservative controlled council agreed at the end of last year to make £1.8 million available to get an independent living complex built in North Walsham. The six apartments and three bungalows planned for Yarmouth Road will be for people aged 18 to 64 with learning disabilities, autism and physical disabilities, with the self-contained flats specially designed to meet their needs. Not-for-profit social housing providers Golden Lane Housing will help get the homes built, but the council now needs to commission a registered care provider, which will provide the support to the people living there. Alison Thomas, the council's cabinet member for adult social care, has agreed to delegate authority to senior adult social care officers to award a contract following a tender process. The council says the estimated value of the five-year care contract would be £3.2 million, with an option to extend it by up to 10 years. County Hall officials say that when the North Walsham scheme is complete and fully occupied, it will save the council at least £240,000 a year. North Norfolk District Council last year granted planning permission for the development on land which used to be home to Westover Vets before that business moved in 2020. Work on the site will start later this year, ready for the first tenants to move in this winter. The council has been trying to address a shortfall in provision of supported living housing in Norfolk. A study in 2021 showed a need for 181 homes, and the council launched a programme to help get more built. So far, 31 new homes have been built and 100 more are in planning, pre-planning, or are under construction.
The council has revealed when work on a major £1.28 million project to repair a crumbling seawall on the Norfolk coast is set to begin. North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, has confirmed that the scheme to help buy time for the village of Overstrand, as it battles against erosion, will start in the spring or summer. The project was agreed last March after the council claimed the seawall had become significantly undermined in several places and the sea had penetrated the corroded sheets. The work will include refurbishment to a 300-metre section of the promenade and will involve sheet piling in front of the existing seawall structure before infilling with concrete. A spokesman for the council has said, "We are in the process of finalising the detailed design and we will be going to tender soon to appoint the contractor for these works." It comes after changes to the shoreline management policy last year required a new approach by NNDC after being told that new sea defences will not be funded. It is believed the costly repairs will buy time for longer-term measures being developed to allow for managed realignment of the coastline. Coastwise, a project launched by the District Council in 2023, is exploring ways in which to help the communities at risk of erosion as part of a £200 million government-funded scheme. The update comes as the Environment Agency announced that coastal communities in Norfolk would receive a share of the £18 million for coastal adaptation projects. This will include selective property purchases or long-time financing solutions in areas where homes face imminent risk from erosion, which could provide a sustainable model for managing coastal transition. In response to the news, Councillor Harry Blathway, Cabinet Member and Portfolio Holder for the Coast, said these challenging times for coastal communities across the UK are here, but this investment will deliver a message of hope about the future. Any objection to the seawall repairs in Overstrand should be submitted to the Secretary of State and the Chief Executive of the Council by March the 5th.
A former Norfolk cafe owner found guilty of rape is due back in court this week to be sentenced. Andrew Hubbard had gone on trial accused of several offences against the woman, who cannot be identified for legal reasons. including two counts of rape, kidnap, and controlling and coercive behaviour. The 34-year-old, who previously owned Lily May's, formerly Kraftburger, in Cromer's New Street, denied all offences said to have occurred between August 2022 and April 2023. But Hubbard was found guilty of rape and another offence of controlling and coercive behaviour following a Norwich Crown Court trial last year. He is due to be sentenced on Friday, February the 13th, after the original hearing, due to be December the 15th last year, was adjourned. The adjournment came after Hubbard, who intends to appeal his conviction, had instructed a new barrister to represent him for the sentencing hearing. Jurors reached the guilty verdict after more than 11 hours and 30 minutes of deliberations. Hubbard was found not guilty of another count of rape. He was also cleared of an offence of kidnap and another offence of voyeurism. Earlier in the trial, which started in October, the jury were directed to find Hubbard not guilty of another offence of escape from lawful custody. Judge Anthony Bate, who adjourned sentencing to allow a pre-sentence report to be carried out, has previously warned Hubbard, "The outcome is almost inevitable," adding he should prepare himself for custody. The trial heard Hubbard came into the bedroom of a property in Cromer with his genitals exposed before raping the victim. Jurors were told by the prosecution the woman knew he wanted her to perform oral sex on him and only did so as she was so scared at that time.
Norfolk, the county that is supposedly winning the battle against thieves, has seen a significant surge in shoplifting. Data released by the Office of National Statistics, the ONS, revealed that reports of yobs grabbing goods has increased to 6,186, up a whopping 13% on last year's statistics. Previously, Paul Sanford, Norfolk's Constabulary Chief Constable, said the force had a zero-tolerance approach to shoplifting in the county. But now the chief, once thought to be the poster boy for cracking down on thieves, has been left red-faced. A spokeswoman for the force said that the numbers, while alarming, reflect the improved reporting from businesses affected by the crime. However, Phil Waite, Deputy Regional Secretary for the East of England for the Union of Shop, Distributive and Allied Workers, said that more needs to be done to protect shop workers in the city. The ONS is a government body that analyses data gathered around the country. Its latest findings show a 13% increase in the number of shoplifting offences from September 24 to September 25, with 6,186 offences reported to the police. This compares to 4,589 offences for the same period in 2023 and 5,499 in 2024. The figures are higher than the national picture, with England as a whole seeing an increase of 6%, up to 491,931 reports in 2025, compared to 462,934 in 2024. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary claims the figures reflect an improved reporting of the crimes. "We recognise the significant impact retail crime has on businesses and individuals," she said. "The increase in shoplifting is a national trend. However, it's important to note in Norfolk that the rate of increase is slowing, with previous ONS data for the 12-month period ending in June 2025 showing shoplifting was up by 22.5%. These figures reflect improved reporting and enforcement. Operation Focus has created thousands of extra hours of policing in areas reporting high volumes of retail crime. Officers have also been working closely with businesses to encourage them to report offences and target prolific offenders.
An award-winning family attraction has announced plans to remove rides ahead of a major new development. Wroxham Barns is getting a new outdoor adventure play area as part of a wider redevelopment to create a more integrated visitor experience for families. The space will rebrand as Wroxham Barns Adventure Farm, and three mechanical rides will be removed from the current fun park to make way for the new play zone. The train ride, jumping pillows and mini golf will all remain as part of the attraction. Its existing fun park will close after the February half term to allow for the safe removal of the rides. It follows feedback from visitors and reflects a shift towards more imaginative and inclusive play experiences. Ian Russell, owner of Wroxham Barns, said, "This is a really exciting step for us and a significant investment in the future of Wroxham Barns. We want to make sure we're giving families the kind of experiences they really value. Imaginative outdoor play that encourages children to explore and be active, while also ensuring the long-term sustainability of the site. Importantly, Wroxham Barns remains very much a place to come for shopping and eating as well as family fun, and this development allows us to bring all those elements together in a much more cohesive way." The Adventure Play area is expected to open in time for the Easter holidays, and during the building period, the farm remains fully open with discounted tickets available for visitors. The shops, food outlets and the existing cafe will also remain open throughout the development. Additional investment will see the creation of a new play cafe, which is set to be completed by the end of May. You are listening to edition number 2004 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 13th February 2026. Still to come, there are items about a Norfolk teacher's retirement and the local legacy of a snooker legend, and of course the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Barbara Stevenson of Skyton writes, "Once again, the matter of the countryside and its revered properties and our beautiful and varied coastline is the subject of head-scratching. Why don't those of ethnic minorities, differing cultures and differing skin colours, spend time away from where they live, usually in cities, by the sea and in the countryside? As with so many questions in respect of such groups, the answer lies in education. The Jesuits have a saying for it: give me the mind of a seven-year-old and I have him for life. For starters, the extremely wealthy National Trust, instead of bemoaning that their visitors, like most of those who flock to the Norfolk coast, are predominantly white and middle class, could open their purse and organise coach trips for children from deprived areas. Taking them to estates and beaches with huge open spaces, with room for races, games, picnics, and as much shouting as they can manage. A great opportunity for some of the elderly and staid volunteers to get their hands grubby, searching for worms and building sandcastles. On the quieter way home, stories could be told of what happened long ago, where they played. Some of the tales very bloodthirsty and scary. Just what children love. The National Trust founder, Octavia Hill, began the organisation as a means of opening up these amazing properties to all. I think she would have happily enjoyed acting out some lurid ghost stories to a rapt audience of grubby, tired children. As a bonus, mobile phones would be banned from such excursions. Helping children learn that real life can be awesome."
Malcolm John Hagen, Rookie. Peacefully at Priscilla Bacon Lodge on February the 1st, 2026, aged 83 years. Beloved husband of Margaret. Loving dad of Marie, Christopher and Tracy. Much loved granddad of Shelley and Jason. Will be sadly missed by all his family and friends. Funeral service at Cromer Crematorium, Wednesday, February the 25th, 11 a.m. No flowers, please. Donations in memory of Malcolm may be shared between Parkinson's UK or Priscilla Bacon Lodge, with cheques payable to NNFS, donations account, care of Lloyd Durham Funeral Services, Avenue Road, High Kelling, NR25 6RD, or online at northnorfolkfuneralservices.co.uk/online-donations/.
And now some local events. Sunday 15th of February, Snowdrop Walks, Spixworth, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m, £4, children free. In the grounds of St Peter's Church, Spixworth, and on Grange Farm, visiting up to three further woods with great areas of snowdrops, St Peter's Church and Grange Farm, Buxton Road, Spixworth, SheilaCook1@gmail.com, 0789-448-3433.
On Wednesday the 18th of February, a discussion entitled No Filters, Communication and Connection with Rowan Egberongby and Christy Watson. It starts at 7 p.m, costs £12, and booking is advised. In this candid and unique discussion, nurse-turned-best-selling author Christy Watson and her daughter Rowan Egberongby explore the challenges of talking about mental health across generations. To be held at the National Centre for Writing, 115-123 King Street, Norwich. info@nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk or telephone number 01603 877 177.
On Tuesday, the 17th of February, Norfolk Countryside Guild of Weavers, Spinners and Dyers demonstration. It will be at 10:30 a.m. until 2 p.m. A demonstration of spinning and weaving, including tapestry, is being run by the Norfolk Wildlife Trust at the Cly and Salhouse Marshes Visitors Centre, on the Coast Road, Holt. More information can be obtained online at info@norfolkwildlifetrust.org.uk or by telephone to 01603 625540. We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we consider a world shared with robots. A visit to a not-so-secret secret village. Discover romance in the written word. And learn a little about Lenny.
Let's begin with an extract from a BBC in-depth report by science correspondent Palab Ghosh. Published on the 28th of October 2025, it investigates the use of robots in the care sector. Hidden away in a lab in northwest London, three black metal robotic hands move eerily on an engineering workbench. No claws or pincers, but four fingers and a thumb, opening and closing slowly, with joints in all the right places. We're not trying to build Terminator, jokes Rich Walker, director of Shadow Robot, the firm that makes them. Bespectacled, with long hair, a beard and a moustache, he seems more like a latter-day hippie than a tech whiz, and he is clearly proud as he shows me round his firm. We set out to build a robot that helps you, that makes your life better, your general-purpose servant that can do anything around the home, do all the housework. But there's a deeper ambition, to address one of the UK's most pressing challenges, the escalating crisis in social care. There were 131,000 vacancies for adult care workers in England, a report by charity Skills for Care found last year. And in all, around 2 million people aged 65 and over in England are living with unmet care needs, according to Age UK. By 2050, one in four people in the UK are expected to be aged over 65 or over, potentially putting more strain on the care system, which is where the robots come in. The previous government announced a £34 million investment in developing robots that could potentially be used to give care. It went as far as saying in 2019 that, within the next 20 years, autonomous systems like robots will become a normal part of our lives, transforming the way we live, work, and travel. Could technology really be the solution? And would you really trust your elderly relatives or yourself when you're at your most vulnerable with what is essentially a very strong machine? Some businesses in the UK are currently testing out robots. Home care provider Caremark has been trialling Genie, a small voice-activated robot, with some people who use their services in Cheltenham. One man who has early onset dementia explained he enjoyed asking Genie to play Glenn Miller songs. Overall, however, reactions have been like Marmite, according to the director Michael Folks, with some people loving Genie and others being less complimentary. But Mr. Folks also stresses these devices aren't about replacing people. We're trying to build a future where carers have more time to care. Back in the laboratory of the Shadow Robot Company in London, Rich Walker points out another big challenge, mastering the perfect robotic hand. For the robot to be useful, it needs to have the same ability to interact with the world as a human does, he explains. And for that, it needs human-like dexterity. The robot hand Mr. Walker shows me certainly seems nimble. It's made from metal and plastic and fitted with 100 sensors with the dexterity and strength of a human hand. Each finger moves to touch its thumb smoothly, quickly and precisely, finishing with an OK to sign off. It can even do a Rubik's Cube one-handed. Yet it is still a long way from doing the more delicate tasks, like using a pair of scissors or picking up smaller, more fragile objects. The way we use a pair of scissors is quite mind-blowing when you think about it, Mr. Walker says. If you try and analyse what happens, you're using your sense of touch in subtle and precise ways and receiving feedback, which makes you adjust the way you cut. How do you tell a robot to do that?
Our next article was published on the NorfolkWriter.com website on the 25th of August 2024. This website claims to be the go-to site for information on Norfolk's best places to visit, and here the focus is on Heydon. Although it often pops up on lists of secret villages, it's probably not apt to call Heydon a secret. Practically everybody knows about it. It has long been used as a backdrop for films and BBC dramas in want of picture-perfect English domesticity. The village was even the setting for a wonderfully iffy 1960s soap opera by the name of Weaver's Green. How many secret villages can you think of that have provided the backdrop for a soap opera? The notion of Heydon's secrecy can be further challenged by how often its village green plays host to vintage craft fairs, bonfires, and other such events that attract great numbers of well-dressed artisans and elderly gents in loose cottons, who seem to always stroll around with their hands held behind their backs. At what age does one begin to adopt this pose? Despite all this, Haydon does retain a furtive aspect. Everybody knows about Haydon, and everybody knows that it's lovely. But go there on a random afternoon, and you'll find it as hallowed and unpeopled as a lone medieval church. Like practically everywhere in Norfolk, Haydon does have a medieval church, and it is suitably hallowed and unpeopled. In fact, Haydon has most of the things you would expect to see in a modern rural settlement, including a gastropub, fairy lights, wood burner, dog's welcome, and a tea room, fairy lights, scones, dog's welcome, on leads. Two things serve to make Haydon unique, however. The first is that it has no through road. To exit the village, you have to turn around and go back the way you entered. Its lack of passing traffic gives the place a solitude unrivalled by similarly picturesque UK hotspots, which are clogged with parked cars on any given day. Better still, the village has recently had a car park installed, meaning there is no reason for automobiles to sully Haydon's secrecy at all. Haydon's second distinctive feature is that every building is from a century past. There are practically no new builds, bar a couple of delicately revamped retail properties, fairy lights, rusty watering cans, dry lavender. The last truly new addition to the village was the little red-bricked Queen Victoria Memorial Well on the Green, built in 1887. Haydon is a watercolour painting of an imaginary England, except that it's all real. The bright red postbox, the bunting-drenched tea room, the leafy churchyard, the row of almshouses, the rose bushes, the sound of a radio foreplay drifting faintly through open upper windows. The whole village has been owned by one Norfolk family since the 1750s, effectively making it Grand Designs proof. Long may the arrangement continue. Haydon is one of those rare places that looks inviting in all weathers. Its cottages and sloping roofs are as pretty when washed in rain as when bathed in sunshine. In fog and snow, the place is almost heartbreakingly cosy. It makes you want to tap on one of the cottage's little window slats and say, "Excuse me, do you mind if I live here with you from now on?" The village has long appealed to cinematographers, hoping to lend their productions an authentic taste of yesteryear. Of all its on-screen appearances, Haydon and its surrounding sweeps of farmland are best captured in Joseph Losey's 1971 adaptation of The Go-Between. Unlike the book, the film features the worst attempt at a Norfolk accent ever committed to film. But the scenery is sumptuous. For me, however, the on-screen moment which best sums up the spirit of Haydon is from a 1985 BBC adaptation of Dickens's Pickwick Papers. In it, the village green plays host to a gentle game of cricket. Watching the programme back now, you'll see that not a bit of Haydon has changed in almost 40 years. I suspect the same would be true for a real Victorian, should they see Haydon today. The world marches on into riots and chaos, but Haydon turns its back on them all. No wonder everyone is trying to keep it secret.
With Valentine's Day approaching, we present two literary works to stir your heart. Our first choice, by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who lived from 1806 to 1861, is entitled How Do I Love Thee? The victim of 1,000 wedding readings, it is part of her sonnets from the Portuguese cycle and was written during her courtship with her husband-to-be. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach, while feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need, by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely, as men strive for right. I love thee purely, as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. Next we have a poem entitled She Walks in Beauty by Lord George Gordon Byron, who lived from 1788 to 1824. He was one of the major figures of the Romantic movement and is regarded as being amongst the greatest British poets. She walks in beauty, like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes. Thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies. One shade the more, one ray the less, had half impaired the nameless grace which waves in every raven tress, or softly lightens o'er her face, where thoughts serenely sweet express how pure, how dear their dwelling place. And on that cheek and o'er that brow, so soft, so calm, yet eloquent, the smile that wins, the tints that glow, but tell of days of goodness spent, a mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent.
Next, we have an article published in the Wroxham and Coltishall Book of October 2025 entitled Lenny's Legacy. Funny man Lenny Henry co-founded Comic Relief 40 years ago, but life hasn't always been a barrel of laughs. 16-year-old apprentice factory worker Lenworth George Henry from Dudley, West Midlands, could not have imagined what his future would hold. But then he made his TV debut on the talent show New Faces in 1975 and won. He subsequently appeared in the children's TV series Tiswas, but it was The Fosters in 1976 in which he played Sonny Foster that gave him his first regular TV role. Lenny has forged a remarkable career as a comedian, actor, writer and campaigner. He was also the co-founder with Richard Curtis of Comic Relief, which since 1985 has raised more than £1 billion to tackle poverty and inequality in the UK and worldwide. It was in 1980 when Lenny teamed up with the comic strip that he met comedienne Dawn French. The couple tied the knot 4 years later and in 1991 adopted their daughter Billy. They remained married for 25 years before divorcing in 2010. 2 years later, Lenny started dating his current partner, theatre producer and casting director Lisa Makin. Lenny was awarded a CBE in 1999 for his services to drama and charity. Further recognition followed in 2015 when he was knighted. He called his investiture at Windsor Castle an extraordinary thing, adding, "But when you're standing there, waiting with the man, you suddenly sober up and go, actually, this is quite a serious thing." It's a wonderful honour, and it's for them, the people of Dudley, and my family. So far, 2025 is proving to be a busy year for Sir Lenny, who turned 67 in August. January saw him star in the Netflix thriller series Missing You. Then in May, Alison Hammond spent time uncovering the man behind the accolades for her Big Weekend on BBC. They stopped off at his childhood home and shared memories of his revered mother Winnie, who, according to Lenny, could throw a man through a brick wall and who would demand doorstep impressions from her son before allowing him in for dinner. Lenny was 2 days into his Australian tour in 1998 when his mum died. He admitted to Alison Hammond that he sought grief counselling. "I felt awful," he said. "I should have just stayed." His mother came to Britain in the second wave of Caribbean immigration in 1957 and settled in the Midlands before having an affair. Lenny was named after Dr. Lenworth, who delivered him. When he was 10, his mother sent him to do chores for his uncle, Bertie, in exchange for pocket money. Lenny helped him every Friday for 18 months until he was told Bertie was his real father, not Winston, the man he had grown up with. In an interview with The Guardian, Lenny revealed he was ashamed of the truth for years, but wants to own it now. "My story is of people moving from one country to another and forming new links, new family and new relationships. And that's just what it is. It's not illicit, it's not salacious in any way. It's a life thing." This July, Sir Lenny closed the 15th Festival of Education held at Wellington College in Berkshire, where he spoke about the importance of identity, representation and belonging in learning environments. "Education gave me the chance to imagine a bigger life. Then it gave me the tools to go and build it." Lenny's autobiography, Who Am I Again?, is available as an audiobook.
Those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include A Postman's Triumph, A Pub's Discount Plans, A New Craft Shop and A Brewery's Global Success.
A chance encounter led to a heartwarming story that would not be out of place in a cosy TV drama. Linda and Jim Oliver, from Norwich, were able to repay a small act of kindness by a stranger, thanks to the ingenuity of a Norfolk postman. The couple's adventure started when they were walking through the village of Brampton near Aylsham and decided to stop at a bench for a rest. They started chatting with one of the villagers and, taken by his kindness, wrote him a thank you letter when they returned home, but they couldn't remember his name or address. Despite the envelope only giving the stranger's dog's name and a vague description of where he lived, a diligent postman managed to deliver it to the right home, sparking a new friendship between the couple and the man. Mr. and Mrs. Oliver were walking through the Norfolk countryside in December when they took a break on a bench in Brampton. The seat, situated near a red telephone box, overlooks a single-track road and is next to a wooden stall where a neighbour sells jam to raise money for the local parish church. While the couple enjoyed their picnic of sandwiches, the owner of the bench, John Sawyer Stone, stepped out to take his dog Dougie for a walk and stopped to greet them on his way. Mr. Oliver, who's 84, said, "We saw this bench in the garden and we sat down. Then the owner came out and we apologised for sitting on his bench, but he said, 'No, no, no, please help yourself.'" While they were chatting, Mrs. Oliver, 83, wanted to purchase a jar of jam but was 25p short, which Mr. Sawyer Stone stepped in to cover for her. He also offered to drop the couple back at their car, which they had parked at the church in Borough, less than a mile away. The couple were so taken by his small gestures, they decided to post him a card thanking him for his kindness. The only problem was they had not taken his name or his address. Mrs. Oliver said she only remembered Dougie's name and that the bench was next to an old telephone box. When addressing her envelope, she wrote, "To the man who lives next to the red telephone box library in Borough or Brampton near Aylsham, Norfolk. He has a dog called Dougie." She said, "I hoped it would get to him because we felt so grateful for his kindness. And then I thought, well, that would be the end of it. But a few weeks later, the couple received a letter through the post signed John and Dougie. All thanks to the excellent detective work of the postman, Mrs. Oliver added. Her husband, who has turned his love for marmalade into a hobby of making it himself, said he wanted to give the Brampton Samaritan a jar to thank you.
The former snooker player and commentator John Virgo, whose name once graced the front of a Norfolk club, has died at the age of 79. His 18-year professional career saw him win the 1979 UK Championship among four non-ranking titles. Alongside that, he is best known for his post-playing career, co-presenting the snooker TV programme and Saturday night favourite Big Break from 1991 to 2002. Following his retirement in 1994, Mr. Virgo took up a full-time commentary position with the BBC. But locally he, or rather his name, will be remembered by those who knew Holt during the early 2000s. The former UK champ, who was also famous for his TV trick shots and wacky waistcoats, officially opened a new-look snooker club which bore his name back in 1999. Friend of 20 years, Roger Reynolds, who was one of the brother Lees, had spent more than £30,000 refurbishing the club. Formerly known as the Leisure Lees, he was looking to give it a new start in life. Speaking to this newspaper at the time, he said, "I just thought I would give John a ring and ask him what he thought about letting me use his name." And he said he didn't mind at all. Mr. Virgo even made the trip from London, ensuring the Saturday night opening would definitely be a sell-out success. Of the opening, he said, "I'm delighted for Roger. I had not seen the club when I said he could use my name, but I'm very impressed. I'm just a friend doing a little bit to help the club kickstart a new beginning, and it's nice for me too." The pair came together through their passion for the game, and had once considered collaborating on a book of snooker facts and anecdotes. Mr. Reynolds also ran the now-closed Broadland Snooker Club in Helsden. Virgo's was housed in the Georgian town's former Regal Cinema, based on Peacock Lane, which closed in 1967. The building was also once used as a bingo hall and was the location of the town's Carnival Queen and attendance competition. The building was demolished in 2004 and flats were later built on the site and named Regal Court. Local legend suggests the flats are haunted by the cinema's former manager, Mr. Pert.
A coastal inn is offering major discounts as part of a new national campaign. The Ship Inn in Munsley is supporting the recently launched Help Out Hospitality initiative, designed to boost footfall and support the hospitality sector during the quieter winter months. "We're really pleased to be supporting the Help Out Hospitality scheme," said Ian Grebanoff, group operations manager for the Original Collection, which operates the Ship Inn. "Hospitality businesses continue to face significant pressure, particularly through the quieter winter months, and initiatives like Help Out Hospitality provide genuine practical support at a time when it's most needed. Being part of a collaborative industry-wide effort that helps operators protect margins, attract guests, and keep trading sustainably is something we strongly believe in, and we're proud to play our part." Inspired by the government's Eat Out to Help Out scheme, Help Out Hospitality brings together more than 50 hotels, restaurants and bars across the UK to offer special promotions. The campaign runs until March 2026 and aims to generate increased bookings during a period when customer numbers and revenue typically decline. Offers under the scheme include discounted hotel stays and food and drink promotions designed to make dining out more affordable. Launched by The Full Range, a UK-wide catering business, the campaign also aims to support the entire hospitality supply chain, including producers and suppliers. Barry Knight, director of The Full Range, said, In recent years, rising food costs have put major pressure on hospitality, and upcoming changes to business rates and wage thresholds will make profitability even tougher. By working together, we can ease the strain and inspire people to enjoy the best of UK hospitality at a time when every visit counts. A commission-free Help Out Hospitality online platform is now live for hospitality businesses to promote offers and to attract direct bookings.
A craft firm is hoping its new shop in North Walsham will help bring more people to the High Street. Ye Broad's Craft Shop opened on Wednesday in Market Street in the town. It is owned by the craft business By the Broads, which is a not-for-profit art and craft gallery that opened in the town in April last year. The business supports around 60 artists who rent out space to sell their handmade arts and crafts. Selina Reed, co-owner of By the Broads, said, "We had a small opening event and we've been very well received so far. We have already come up with ideas for connections with other businesses, such as the wedding shop next door. There is a great community among the independent businesses, and I am passionate about bringing more people to North Walsham's High Street. There's no empty shops, and we have a great history. The business is also hoping to launch a newsletter to boost the local artists that it works with. The shop is managed by Kieran Davidson, who has his own craft business, Red Panda Crafts Norfolk. He started his firm in Sprowston and has rented spaces in Beccles, Henstead, Dereham and Norwich. In October 2024, Mr. Davidson was awarded the Business in the Community Award by Broadland District Council. He is selling his own wares, including handmade candles and diffusers, in the shop as well." Ms. Reed added, "I often get involved in community meetings about local businesses, and I am hoping Kieran will too. Shopping should be an experience and not just pressing buttons online. I also want to see it across Norfolk, not just in North Walsham. By the Broads also offers craft workshops and encourages people to check its social media for further events at the shop and gallery."
Norfolk's largest brewery has partnered with a global drinks exporter to drive its international expansion. Woodford's Brewery, based in Woodbastwick, has announced a 3-year export agreement with Cheshire-based export sales agency Cheers Global, which has been given exclusive rights to distribute its beers worldwide. Paul Sullivan, Woodford's chief executive, said Cheers Global's expertise in drinks export and network of importers and distributors worldwide makes it the perfect partner to support the Norfolk Brewery's growth in international markets. Craig Johnston, Cheers Global's founder and managing director, said, "Woodford's represents exactly what today's beer consumers are returning to: good quality, consistent beer rooted in tradition and provenance. As market trends continue to shift towards authenticity and reliability, there is renewed demand for breweries that deliver flavour and craftsmanship without compromise. We're delighted to be representing Woodford's Brewery and look forward to introducing their range to overseas markets." Mr. Johnson launched Cheers Global in 2024. It specialises in working with drinks brands, helping them to realise their international ambitions by giving them a presence in the global marketplace.
The new owner of a tea room in Norfolk's poshest town has been blown away after a busy first month. Owl Tea Rooms in Holt reopened on January the 5th after Ali Lowe carried out a complete refurbishment over the Christmas period. Ms. Lowe has worked in catering since school and spent weeks transforming the building into her dream business. The tea room has since gained lots of new customers, as well as welcoming regular faces. Ms. Lowe said, "I've been blown away. We have got so many regular customers. On Saturdays, we're so busy that we have to ask people to book. After changing hands, the bakery menu stayed much the same, with a few new additions, such as a classic Victoria sponge and a lemon drizzle cake. Savoury dishes have also been going down very well, with soup being the biggest seller. People were worried that the menu would change, but we kept the bakery menu much the same, and people have been coming back. The only thing I have changed is a couple of suppliers, because I think it's really important that our food and drink is locally sourced, Ms Lowe added. Ms Lowe also made her mark on the tea room by giving it a new 1920s-style makeover, which has received positive feedback. She added, "The positive response about the new decor has been lovely. Customers love it and say it has a warm, cosy atmosphere, which is exactly what I wanted." New cakes are not the only thing that has been added after the business changed hands. The tea room's afternoon teas have also had a revamp and a nice makeover with the addition of gold cake stands.
A North Norfolk beach trail has been named among the best walks in the UK for 2026 in a national survey. The consumer group Which asked members to rate walks according to difficulty, distance, scenery, places of interest, signage, wildlife, peace and quiet, visitor facilities, accessibility, parking and food and drink. A 7.5 mile trek at Wells Beach and Pinewoods Walk made it onto the final rankings, with an overall score of 81%, which is the highest for the East of England. The walk, which takes between 2 and 3 hours and starts at Wells next to the sea, was ranked 2 out of 5 for difficulty. Starting in Wells, this fairly flat route takes people past sand dunes, the busy harbour, and through a woodland of tall pine trees. It scores 4 stars for both its scenery and wildlife and its parking facilities. Which recommended that tired walkers stop for a drink and a bite to eat at the Wells Beach Cafe at the end of their wander.
A pharmacy in a Norfolk town is set to reopen under a new firm after months of uncertainty and claims of unacceptable service levels. Jute's Pharmacy in Station Road, Sheringham, will be opening its doors under a new company, Allied Pharmacies, within the next fortnight. It comes after the store, which was one of many across the country, had several unexpected closures and medication shortages causing chaos for patients. North Norfolk MP Stephen Acheron recently announced the news of the reopening after meeting with the new owners. He said, "After months of uncertainty, this is a huge relief. The new owners understand the challenges that our local branch has faced and the suffering it has caused residents who were hit with medicine shortages and unacceptable service levels for far too long. This is about more than a building reopening. It's about restoring a vital service at the heart of our community. In the meantime, we owe a huge debt of thanks to the Boots staff who have gone above and beyond to support residents through an incredibly tricky period." In October, Mr. Acheron discussed the matter in Parliament, where he said people in the town had suffered from unacceptable services from the branch for almost 2 years. He went on to explain that there had been a shortage of drugs and pharmacists alongside issues with paying staff, and said that one local was left standing out in the rain in front of the closed pharmacy after they were sent there by 111 for emergency antibiotics. The government warned some Jutes pharmacies could lose the right to dispense NHS prescriptions following complaints. In November, it was announced that Allied Pharmacies had taken over 61 Jutes stores across the UK and a further 68 branches in December. The Jutes chain went into administration last month.
Our last few articles cover a teacher's retirement, a bookshop's March events, audio programmes at a local theatre, and a new pizza takeaway.
When she first began her teaching career, chalkboards and overhead projectors were key instruments in the classroom. Rebecca Newman, 54, has been teaching in Norfolk for 31 years, with the last 10 spent as executive head teacher of the Eden Federation. But now she is getting ready to plan holidays rather than lessons, as she is set to retire at the end of the academic year. And as Ms. Newman prepares to step down, she has reflected on her time with the Federation, which runs Causton Primary, St. Peter's in Easton, Hockering Primary, and Great Witchingham Primary. She said, "There is always something new every day. I'm going to miss the people the most. I have worked with incredible children and amazing and talented staff." She started teaching in Swaffham for a couple of years before becoming a teacher at St. Peter's in Easton in 1997. She continued to move up the ladder and became executive head in 2016. One of her favourite moments of her career has been taking the children from the four schools to sing at the O2 in London for the Young Voices programme. "I loved singing with the children and teaching them new songs," she said. Over the years, she has seen several changes, including when teachers had to adapt to remote learning during the pandemic, as well as a range of new technology entering the classroom. But she said one thing that has changed the most has been the workload. She said the role of a teacher is more than just teaching. It is the support for pupils and families. It is the safeguarding and communication with parents. The workload is more now. The news was announced to parents with letters from CEO Oliver Burwood and Ms. Newman herself. In Mr. Burwood's letter, she has enriched children's experience of school over a number of years and created happy and harmonious and successful learning environments across the Federation.
A bookshop is hosting two author events in March. The events are being presented by the Holt Bookshop, Sunday Times best-selling novelist Sally Page and acclaimed author and journalist Justine Picardy will appear at events in Clye and Holt on March the 11th and 12th. The bookshop will host Sally Page at Clye Windmill on March the 11th for the launch of her latest novel. The story follows Kate, who long ago set aside her dream of painting, and Bardi, a retired English teacher with writer's block. The narrative unfolds as they follow a trail of mysterious Shakespeare quotes appearing in their community. Ms. Page's previous titles include The Keeper of Stories and The Book of Beginnings. Tickets for the event are £5 and include a drink. Pam Horrocks, co-owner of the Holt Bookshop, said, "We're absolutely delighted to be welcoming Sally Page to Clye Windmill. Her books are always hugely popular with our customers, and this new novel is full of warmth, hope, and beautifully drawn characters. Launching the new novel in such a special local venue will make it a really lovely evening." On March the 12th, Justine Picardy will appear at St Andrew's Church in Holt to discuss Fashioning the Crown, a story of power, conflict, and couture. Her latest work explores the role of royal fashion in shaping the British monarchy. Keith Britton, co-owner of the Holt Bookshop, said, "This is a fascinating, beautifully illustrated book, and Justine Picardy brings the subject to life in a really engaging way. It's a great opportunity for anyone interested in royal history, fashion, or design, and we're very pleased to be welcoming her to Holt." Tickets are £8 or £30, including a copy of the book. They are available from the Holt Bookshop or at tickettaylor.com/events/theholtbookshop/1962196. Contact sales at holtbookshop.co.uk or call 01263 715 858.
Sheringham Little Theatre is launching a new series of audio dramas. The first play, The Other Side of the World, tells the story of renowned TV reporter Alan Wicker in 1958 and marks the beginning of a series of free audio dramas. Simon Moorhead, a trustee at Sheringham Little Theatre, and the producer behind the project, said, "We are looking to expand the reach of the Little Theatre beyond our four walls. Our aim is to give local actors and writers a new platform to showcase their work. So we will also be turning to some of our own Sheringham shows and turning them into audio, including entries into our playwriting competition." Listeners can access the recordings by visiting the theatre and picking up cards, which are printed with QR codes. The project holds personal meaning for Mr. Moorhead, as the debut play features his father, Cyril, who worked as Alan Wicker's cameraman. The drama features an 18-strong cast led by television and radio impersonator John Colshaw as Wicker. Mr. Moorhead said, "It's based on factual episodes of Wicker's world, including when Alan and Dad nearly started World War III while filming in Hong Kong, and their aircraft pilot, who should have been following a river back into the harbour, followed a road into China, resulting in them being shot at by anti-aircraft guns. They made it back, but my mum started getting calls from the press saying, 'Do you know that they nearly started World War III?'" The hour-long play was recorded in Greenwich at the studio run by Moorhead's daughter and son-in-law. Mr. Moorhead is a volunteer trustee on the board of the charity which operates Sheringham Little Theatre as a North Norfolk community arts venue. To listen to the other side of the world, visitors can collect a card from the theatre's hub or box office.
A new pizza takeaway shop, believed to be a Domino's, has been given the go-ahead in a Norfolk town. The proposal to transform 19 Munsley Road in North Walsham into a hot food takeaway premises has now been approved by North Norfolk District Council. The plans, which were lodged in December, had included the installation of extraction and ventilation equipment alongside numerous alterations to accommodate the business. While the bid has been submitted by Hicks Properties, one of the document's headers said Domino's Projects, which some people have indicated are plans for the pizza giant Domino's. The documents also mention DPSK Limited as being the client. This company is responsible for making applications on behalf of Domino's. The planning officer, who approved the bid, said, "It is sustainably located within a designated town centre of one of the district's largest settlements, with reasonable and safe access to pedestrian links, a public car park and public transport. The design of the scheme is considered to be acceptable, as is the impact on residential amenity." One of the conditions said that the premises should only be open to customers between 11 a.m. and 11 p.m. each day.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smart phone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was David Mitchell. Editing and producing this issue was Rick Waghorn. A Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's cheerio!